morning. We'll get started.
This is pretty helpful.
So last time was just a review slash overview of basic network concepts, and so again, things that I would expect you to have in the back of your mind when we're talking about any sort of network. We'll be talking about wireless networks here, obviously, and so we looked at it from a somewhat historical perspective. And so traditionally, there were two sorts of networks: telephone networks, which were transmitting voice signals, and data networks, which were transmitting digital data of some sort. And we noted that these days, that the types and numbers of applications have expanded a bit since that historical point that we were looking at. And this has introduced potentially a need for some sort of quality of service notion and provisioning within networks. And again, as we go on through various sort of specific examples of wireless networks, we'll tend to mention what sort of quality of service provisioning is available for those sorts of networks. Okay, then very abstractly, we said that networks could be viewed as offering services, which, again, at the very least, had a couple of parameters. They were connection-oriented or connection-less, and reliable versus unreliable, which, again, doesn't get you too far in the quality of service direction, but did tend to accommodate the sort of basic forms of data that traditionally were around. Okay, and so then finally, we noted that networks are built along sort of very specific lines, which accommodate, again, this need of provisioning of various services. And so we have circuit versus packet switched networks, so something that provides a bit pipe versus something which chunks data up into packets and sends the data along packet by packet. And for packet switching, we noted that a layered architecture was used. So the tasks associated with, are there any questions? With a specific, with the transmission of data, were divided up in subtasks, and each of these was essentially performed sequentially, relying on the task before it. So you could think of the physical transmission of bits, the making that into a point-to-point connection, then a multi-hop connection, and finally a process-to-process connection. So as we go through various portions of this module, you will see that some of these concepts coming to the fore. Again, be aware that the cellular networks arose from the telephony world, and so at least originally the cellular networks would have had a circuit switch architecture. So a lot of what we're saying will apply to that and not the layered architecture. So it's just worth realizing that there is a difference and sort of where sort of the various flavors apply. Okay, So what we're going to look at today is a fairly abstract model of a digital communications system. And with the physical transmission being over a radio link. Okay. And so I've included a number of references. The William Stallings reference is sort of probably the main reference for the initial part of this module. And so I've said a lot of what's discussed today comes from chapters 6 and 7 of Stallings. Loads of wireless communications books exist. Andrea Goldsmith is a good source, and it gets into more detail than we will. So if you like the sort of low-level stuff, it's a very good reference. Bruce Black is sort of gives you, again, more of an overview, and again, it gives you a good introduction to the radio principles as applied to specifically cellular systems. Okay, so the model that we're going to consider today is concerned with the transmission of digital data, again, over a radio channel. And we're going to broadly note that there are a number of steps that need to be sort of addressed in transmitting that data. The data we're considering for today is primarily voice data, okay? And so, again, if you think of a circuit versus packet switch, this is more of a circuit switching system. We're not really going to worry about packaging things up into packets and all of sort of, again, the network-oriented procedures that you have to go through to get things through networks. We're just worrying about, again, a point-to-point connection to transmit our data. Okay. And so we have a number of steps. First of all, potentially our message source could be analog, so your initial voice signals are probably analog. And so we want to convert that into bits, so we'll have an analog to digital converter. Possibly our message source is already digital. Okay. Now, in order to transmit this efficiently, we may have a source encoder. So the purpose of a source encoder would be to make that digital representation as efficient as possible, so in some way compress potentially that digital representation, so you have to send as few bits as possible. And again, we'll look at source encoding for voice signals. So we'll see how we can get from our standard analog to digital representation of a voice signal to something that takes less bits to transmit. Now, within any channel, there's the possibility of errors, and so channel encoding is the adding of some sort of redundancy in order to combat errors and try to deal with errors as they arise. Okay. And so what we'll have at this point, coming out of a channel encoder, again, is some sequence of stream of bits
or
packet or stream of packets, and that has to be represented in some way that can be transmitted over a radio channel. And so the idea of modulation is the idea of turning this set of bits essentially back into an analog signal, so back into a sinusoidal signal. Okay, and then that signal is transmitted over our radio channel, and when it gets to the other end, you have to rewind all of those, so you have to convert your bits back into some sort of binary sequence. You have to interpret the redundancy to give you sort of your best estimate of what the initial bit sequence was. That sequence then has to be turned into your message, okay? Which ultimately, again, could be an audio signal out. So, today what we're going to look at, or make some comment on, is essentially everything except the RF link itself. And so what we'll see is that, you know, that RF link is, and the characteristics of the RF link are quite critical for how our systems are designed. So we'll have a look at that sort of on its own and see how it impacts on how we design systems. Okay, so this is essentially a summary of what I just said. So we want to send a message from a source to a sink. Primarily in this lecture, we're considering that message to be a voice transmission. And for our purposes, the physical transmission of the data has to be over a radio link. Okay. And so, again, we have a number of steps that we have to go through, and we'll be saying something about each of these steps as we go along. And what we're saying is going to be fairly generic, so the fact actually that we have a radio channel to physically transmit our data isn't too crucial to what we're saying, although it does come into play in certain aspects. For instance, the driver behind source encoding for voice signals is, again, the limited bandwidth that we have available on radio channels. So, as an example, in your wired telephony system, again, you can just provision to send your 64 kilobit per second signal along, and there's no real problem. But, again, because of the limitations of the radio channel, it's a struggle to send that amount of data, or traditionally was a struggle to send that amount of data, and that drove the need to compress that data into sort of lower bandwidth signals. Again, we're not going to say a lot about channel coders, not at the moment. We'll mention that when we look at specific examples of networks, we'll say something about the channel encoding, but again, the driver for channel coders in wireless systems is the idea that the loss rates are actually significantly higher for wireless systems than they would be for wired, And so you need some coding to try and combat that error rate. Modulation is a sort of a, it's a somewhat complex topic in terms of the two goals for modulation are going to be to limit the power at which you have to transmit your bits, so to keep that as low as possible, and also to, again, use your bandwidth as efficiently as possible, so to transmit as high a bit rate within a given bandwidth as possible. And so, again, we'll take a look at typically the two factors are have to be traded off. So obviously, the higher the power, the more you can, the higher the rate you can send at. But we'll look at how the trade-off works and how it's dependent on what modulation scheme you'll use. We'll stop short of a full discussion of modulation for wireless systems, again, because spread spectrum would be one technique that's very common, because, again, it's resistant to noise within the network. But again, it's sufficiently complex that we'll treat it as a topic on its own. So what we'll see here are, you know, the basic frequency shift, phase shift modulation schemes. And the main thing we're examining here is, again, the trade-off between bandwidth efficiency and error rates. And again, finally, we'll look at the radio channel in isolation. Okay, so again, we're just going to have a look at each of the separate components except for the radio channel itself. And again, we're going to look at that in the context of performance. So, channel capacity, how many bits can you send, and part of, and going along with that spectral efficiency, so how much frequency do you need to send those bits, and how that sort of relates again to the error rate, and also the power at which you have to send the signal. Okay, so the first sort of basic principle of channels, which again I'm sure you've seen before, is that we cannot send an unlimited amount of information. Okay. And the limit on the basic limit on the information that can be sent is related to the signal-to-noise ratio, so the power of a signal relative to the power of noise within the system. Okay. And so the noise limits the capacity of the system and introduces errors into the system. And again, there's a number of sources for noise within a system. The classic is thermal or white noise, and so this just exists in the atmosphere and is uniformly distributed across the system. And typically, this is the noise that's considered when we're talking about
capacity, signal to noise ratios and capacity.
So noise is also introduced by the system itself and the sort of physical limitations of the system. So you can have intermodulation noise, where if a medium is shared, then if multiple signals share the medium, then they might interfere with each other, sort of even if they're technically in different bandwidths, because again, the bandwidths aren't actually sharp. Okay. And then you can have things like crosstalk, and also impulse noise. So impulse noise is just sort of unpredictable noise, which sort of again tends to spike and obliterate signals. So typically when we're examining a channel, we talk about the signal-to-noise ratio, and this is not the spikes in noise, but this is the uniform sort of background noise, and what the power of that versus the power at which we're receiving our signal. And the Shannon capacity, channel capacity theorem says that the capacity of a channel, C, is related to the bandwidth of the channel, B, and the log of the signal to noise ratio. Now, the thing to keep in mind with the Shannon capacity theorem is that this is sort of the absolute maximum amount of information you can send over a channel. The actual amount of information you can send over a channel is going to be dependent on the transmission techniques that you use, the coding techniques that you use. So this is a theoretical limit, and it's rarely achieved in practice. Okay. Now, something just again to think about is that we can view various processes that by which we transform our signals and sort of the reliability, the accuracy of those processes as contributing additional noise factors. So if you want to, you can sort of bundle various sort of coding inaccuracies into your signal-to-noise ratio. Okay, and again, this is going to impact on the capacity that you will get from that channel. Okay, we'll see that a bit as we go along. Okay, so this really is just a sidebar, something I like to mention because I always get questions at some point when people start looking at the problem sets. And that is just to note that signal-to-noise ratios are frequently expressed in decibels. And as you recall, a decibel just is 10 log 10 of your quantity. And so if you encounter a decibel quantity, then in order to use the Shannon capacity theorem, you have to translate back out of decibels. So again, just be aware that a lot of these quantities are expressed sort of either as an absolute value or in decibel form, and make sure you're using the right one at the right time. Okay. Okay. So we've been talking about the signal to noise ratio. But our signals actually have, they have a very specific form or very specific interpretation, and that is of the bit. And so EB over N0, the bit energy to noise power density, is essentially a normalization of the signal to noise ratio relative to the transmission of the bit. And so the signal energy per bit, again, is EB. And this is the signal power divided by our data rate. So we have an absolute amount of power in the signal, and then you use a bit of it for each bit. Okay. And similarly, the noise in a specific bandwidth is N0 times BT. So N0 is a density, and then you can, to get a specific amount of noise, you look at it over a specific over a bandwidth. Okay. Now these two interpretations allow you to again relate EB over N0 to your signal to noise ratio. So just plugging in EB is S over R, N0 is N over N times BT, and so working that out, you'll get that EB over N0 is your signal to noise ratio times BT, the bandwidth over which you're transmitting relative to the bit rate. Now, our quantity R over BT is known as the bandwidth efficiency. Okay? And so what it's showing you is what sort of rates we can get relative to a bandwidth. Okay? And so obviously, the higher the rate relative to the bandwidth, the happier we are. Again, we're packing more bits into a fixed bandwidth. Or similarly, if you fix the rate, you want to be able to transmit that in as small a bandwidth as possible to get the maximum usage out of your channel. Okay. So we'll return to this later, after we've had a discussion about modulation, and we'll see how that impacts on these various factors. Okay. Now, sort of related to our bandwidth efficiency is spectral efficiency, and so spectral efficiency is the ratio of the channel capacity to channel bandwidth. So again, ideally, you either want a higher capacity for a fixed bandwidth or a fixed capacity over as small a bandwidth as possible. Okay. And so if we take a look at Shannon's capacity theorem and then our definition of bit energy to noise density, then we can get a minimum bit energy to noise density ratio that we would need to achieve a given spectral efficiency. So we get a relationship between our spectral efficiency terms and our bit energy to noise density ratio. Okay. So again, we can think of the need to increase energy to increase increase spectral efficiency. Okay, so again, we'll return to those ideas later in the lecture. And again, see the role of specifically modulation plays in that in those trade-offs. So now, again, if we assume that we have our voice signal, voice is obviously an analog signal, and the first thing we're going to need to do is to digitize that signal. Okay. And again, this was mentioned last lecture, but the traditional digitization of a voice signal uses, first of all, the Nyquist sampling theorem, which states that an analog signal can be fully recovered if it's sampled at twice, at a rate of twice the signal bandwidth. And so the maximum frequency for voice is taken to be 4,000 hertz. And so we'll need to sample that signal 8,000 times per second. Now, those samples are still not digital representations. They exist on sort of the real number line, so they could be any number. So we have to further encode those samples using bits. And so obviously, whatever number of bits you are, you're only going to have a finite number of encodings. So if you use 2 bits, you get 1 to 4. Typically, we take 8 bits per sample. And again, just take whichever value is closest to what we require. And this leads to a 64 kilobit per second voice representation. So your standard telephony signal, digitized signal for voice. Okay. So the sampling and digitization of voice in this manner is referred to as pulse code modulation. And we'll just again note that it does the digitization of these samples introduces an error. Your digital representation is not exactly the same as the sample value. And so again, we can think of that error as contributing to our signal to noise ratio. And it does it in a very specific fashion, and dependent on the number of bits used. Okay, so here again we have an example of our post-pulse code modulation. Just for the purposes of drawing a picture, we haven't used 8 bits, we've only used 4 bits, so we have 16 values for our signal. And what we see here is that you have, at each point, you have an actual sample value. Okay. And then that actual sample value, so in this first case it's 1.1, that actual sample value has to be matched to the closest code value available. So in this case, 1, and again, with a 4-bit representation. Now, what we saw in the previous example was all of the values were evenly spaced. That doesn't necessarily yield the best results. We may employ nonlinear encoding to reduce the error for low amplitude signals. So in other words, what we might want is to have more values representing our low power signal, our low amplitude signals than the higher amplitude signals. So we don't have to use a linear range. And so here over on the this side, the B, we see this where we use smaller ranges sort of for the low power signals and then larger ranges for high power signals. And the same, and it's just observed that the same effect can be achieved by altering the signals themselves, so maybe changing the magnitude of signals and then keeping your uniform distribution of values. But one way or the other, it's desirable again to get these low power signals or low amplitude signals. Okay, so again, that's our basic digitization of a voice signal. And so this worked for quite a while with telephony signals or telephony data. With the advent of wireless systems, you know, there was a premium on bandwidth, and hence the premium on the trying to reduce the bit rate of your signaling. And so various compression techniques were introduced to try and lower the amount of data that had to be used to represent a voice signal, and indeed other signals as well. So the function of a source encoder is to reduce the amount of data that needs to be transmitted. Okay, so there's again 2 flavors of source encoding, lossy or loss-free. So In some cases, you can use just the property of the data to transmit the same amount of information with less bits. Yeah, typically, voice compression doesn't do that. Typically, we make approximations to our signal, and these approximations again lead to some error or inaccuracy in the representation. So, we're going to look at how we can compress voice signals and some techniques for compressing voice signals. The first set of these essentially are sort of modifications of our pulse code modulation techniques, and so the goal is to represent the signal as it is, and so these are basic speech coding methods, and so pulse code modulation will be taken as our baseline, and then the remainder of these techniques, differential pulse code modulation, adaptive differential pulse code modulation, delta modulation, continuous variable slope delta modulation, are all ways of essentially approximating these pulse code modulation signals or samples using less bits. And typically what they're going to rely on, again, is that the change between one sample and the next is not going to be too great. And so what we'll see is we can get down to a certain bit rate, and with, again, at some point, too much degradation in quality. In an attempt to reduce the bit rates even further, a second class of speech coders was introduced, and these are model-based coders, and these do not attempt to directly transmit some representation of the speech signal. So again, you can think of the sampling as what you're doing, you're transmitting this representation of the speech signal. Model-based coders attempt to, again, come up with a mathematical model for this signal, one that's understood by the sender and the receiver. And instead of sending samples, it will send parameters for these models. And so hopefully the amount of information you need to send to represent the parameters is less than directly sending the samples. Okay. So, again, we're taking pulse code modulation as our baseline. So we have our 64 kilobit per second, 8,000 samples per second with 8 bits to transmit each sample. Okay. Now, what differential pulse code modulation does is it's essentially still going to try and send those samples, but it's going to instead of sending each sample, it's going to send the difference between one sample and the next. So if you have your first sample, then to get your second sample, all you need to know is how it differed from the first one. Once you know that, all you need to get the third is to know how it differed from the second one. So just adding on the difference each time. Okay. And again, we're going to make the assumption that the differences between consecutive samples is going to be relatively small. So you're not going to bounce from one end of the range to the other end of the range over the space of one sample. So it's going to be more smooth than that. And since it's smoother, since we're not representing as big a range, then we hope that we don't have, that we can represent the differences in less bits. So we have this big range, takes 8 bits to represent. We're hoping that, you know, the differential range is smaller. So again, if you have a smaller range, you can cover the same amount of territory with less bits. And so this works reasonably well, but occasionally the difference between samples will exceed the range you've defined, and therefore you will have a loss or an inaccuracy to the signal being introduced. Adaptive differential pulse code modulation is, again, a step on from the differential pulse code modulation, and the difference here is in how the sample is, the next sample is determined. And so you send on the differences as before, but now you make predictions of the samples based not only on the current data, but upon previous versions as well. Okay. And so now, if we rely on, again, our previous data, so again, for trends in how the differences are going, then we assume that we can send even less data at any given time. So we have our current data, but we also have previous data, which feeds into our estimation. Okay. And so typical values sent now are 4 bits. So in that case, we've halved our data rate. Okay. And like for pulse code modulation, we can adapt our quantization levels to suit the current system. So again, the idea is that we're still trying to reconstruct these sample values, our 8,000 sample values per second. Okay. Delta modulation is a special case of differential pulse code modulation, and here we only allow the change to have two representations, you either go up by one or down by one. Okay, so you go up one level or down one level. And so what you can gather from that is that, again, you need one bit for the transmission, and it's very, so it's very, well, two bits for the transmission. But what you, obviously that any time you have a sort of a high change, you're not going to be able to capture that change. And so over time, as the change sort of levels out, you sort of come close, but you're getting a sort of very fairly crude approximation of the original signal. And so you get low data rates, but the voice quality is not spectacular. The primary usage of this form of modulation is within military operations, so where quality is not necessarily as much of an issue as just efficiency. Okay, so again, all of those techniques are trying to recreate our initial 8,000 samples per second and reconstruct our signal from those samples. Okay. And so we say it's a direct representation of the audio signal. An alternative approach is to build some sort of parameterized model of the sound source, and for sound source, again, for our purposes, read voice. And so now, for some fixed unit of time, here, 20 milliseconds is a fairly typical chunk of time to consider. We look at the audio signal in that time unit, and we try to come up with a model for that audio signal. We then do some curve fitting you have a model for the signal, and what you do is you have curve fitting to parameterize that model. And then, so your sender knows the model and it's curve fitted to that model essentially, and your receiver knows the model. So if you send the model parameters, the receiver can reconstruct your signal based on those parameters. Okay, so one of the basic forms of model-based encoding is what's called linear predictive coding. And it allows us to achieve quite low bit rates of 4.8 kilobits per second, but it's considered that the quality of the signal is not spectacular. It sounds fairly synthetic. So a lot of modern voice codecs are based on enhancements of the basic LPC coding. Basically, you have your parameterized model, but then you try to send additional information that will sort of smooth over the synthetic nature, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So, again, with LPC, we take our 20 microsecond chunks of the voice signal, and we analyzed them to see how they were produced. And so essentially we're taking, what we do essentially is take a transfer function and then parameterize that, and then send the parameters along. Okay. And so the model considers sort of a number of factors when within the model, and so each of these again would be modeled and then combined. So you have loudness, voiced or unvoiced, so is there a signal or is it just quiet, pitch, vocal tract considerations, vocal cord synthesizer or an unvoiced synthesizer. So this is essentially just an sound noise, and the vocal cord synthesizer will model how the vocal cord works. Gain is associated with loudness. And so again, at the end of all this, you have parameters for each of these components, and you transmit on the parameters. And then based on those parameters, the receiver, which again has the same view of how, of the model of the voice, based on this, the receiver will decode the signal. And so the goal of the parameter prediction or the parameter determination is to try to minimize the mean square error between the predicted signal and the actual signal. So again, essentially a curve fitting exercise. Okay, so again, that gives you a reasonably synthetic sounding output. And so again, models have been proposed that take the basic approach of LPC, but try to enhance the output signal. Okay. And so the way they do this is they try to, in some way, characterize the difference between the modeled signal and the actual signal. And what they'll do is produce a code book or a list or of typical differences, so typical residue values. And so what you can do then is you compare your signal to the modeled signal. Then you get a residue, you compare the residue to typical residue values, and you pick the one that's closest, and you indicate which of these residue, which out of this library of residues is closest, and you send that information along with your parameters. Okay. So, in addition to using the basic LPC, you can then add in this residue value to improve your signal. Okay. And so, again, here you see we have this code book, and we'll pick one of these values to add into our signal to make it more realistic. Okay, so those are the two basic forms of speech coding. Again, typically modern cellular systems are going to use some model-based encoding to transmit voice signals. So again, something where they can get quite low data rates relative, again, to the full pulse code modulation approach. So in addition to just sort of basic techniques, the thing to keep in mind, again, is that this is introducing some sort of error or inaccuracy into the system, so there is a degradation in the quality of your representation. Okay, so we now have some sort of bit stream, and we want to send this over our radio link, and as we said, doing so is potentially going to introduce errors, so not all of the bits are going to arrive in one piece at the end. And typically, the rate of errors, so the percentage of errors in a bit stream, is going to be higher than it would be in a wired system. So again, there are concerns with dealing with the errors that are introduced as the bits are transmitted. The purpose of channel encoding then is to deal with the errors introduced into the system. Okay. So we would like to detect and or correct errors introduced into the system. And the only way to do this, essentially, is to send additional information, redundant information in your bitstream. Okay. And so, you know, if you had no additional information, you know, if you lose a bit, well, how do you know? So somehow you want to be clever and add some bits into the system that will give you some information, again, about what the original set of bits was. Okay. And so, if you detect errors, well, you can either ask for the message to be repeated, again, that's a more of a networking function, or you can just ignore that bit of the information. And then, obviously, if you have enough information, you can try and repair that bit of the information. Again, typically, wireless cellular systems are going to use some combination of detection and correction. Okay. And I'm not going to say a lot about the coding techniques now, but again, as we go along, particularly in the cellular system, we'll see what the coding techniques actually allow for and how they do it. Okay, and so again, this is you will have encountered this sort of coding before. If you've taken a networks class, typically the main place it's discussed is in the in reference to a data link layer. Okay. And so you'll have seen some results like this, where we have our information divided up into chunks, and some additional information added onto that chunk to give some information about what the bits were like in the chunk. Okay, and again, what's the simplest thing? The simplest thing would be a parity code. So you have a fixed number of zeros or one, and you add one more bit, which just indicates whether the number of zeros or one was odd or even. And so if a single bit gets changed, what happens? Well, that odd or even goes the opposite direction. You know there's a problem. You know there's a problem, but you can't detect what the problem was. So that's just an example. Again, you've seen it before. What we can say at a very abstract level is that what we want to do with these code bits is to spread the sequence of, or spread the information so the data plus code bits as far apart from each other as possible. And so the Hamming distance between two sequences, D, is just the number of bits by which the two sequences differ. And so if we look at all possible data and its coding, then we can look at the minimum distance between any two words, and we can correct d min minus 1 over 2 bit positions. So essentially what this result is giving us is some handle on what it takes to correct problems within the data. So don't worry overly much about this, except, again, to know that there is sort of significant overhead. You have to add more bits in order to correct data than to just detect problems in the data. Okay. So the types of code are numerous. We have block error correcting codes, so you take your data and you chunk it up into some fixed size chunks, and within that you have parity codes, Hamming codes, cyclic redundancy codes. Okay. Now, again, if you have something like voice streams, so continuous streams of data, convolution codes that are used to apply to the bit streams. Okay. We're not going to go into the details of any of these coding procedures now. Again, we'll mention something about convolution codes later on when it comes to sort of specific examples, because again, if you have these streams of data, convolution codes will be used to check its correctness. Okay. So what we can note is that potentially we get what's called a coding gain. So adding these bits can potentially, anyway, improve the quality of the signal. Okay, and so this is an example again from Stallings. And what we see is that, again, if we look at the bit error rate versus the energy to noise ratio, bit energy to noise density ratio, we see that again, for any fixed bit error rate, then coding can reduce the amount of energy we have to send into the system, essentially by correcting any problems. And similarly, for any energy, fixed bit energy rate, we can reduce our bit error rate by introducing coding. At some point, again, you get into, sort of towards the origin here, you get into a state where you actually have more errors than the noise is actually overwhelming the bit signal, and in that case, no sort of encoding is going to happen. So you have to have some basic level of power in your bit transmission to overcome noise, and then once you have that, encoding can help, but if you don't have that, then encoding won't help. Okay, so I'll call a break at this point. When we come back, we'll look at some basic modulation schemes for our signals. So this is translating bits into some sort of sinusoidal representation, and sort of more interesting than any sort of specific scheme, again, you've probably seen a lot of these schemes before, is the interplay between the scheme, between the bandwidth efficiency and the bit error rate. So we'll see energy, bit error rate, bandwidth efficiency, and how they interplay and how it's related to these schemes.